Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Our guest says most ordinary folks are not ordinary upon closer inspection. Our guest, Dr. Bill Stork. He's not here as our regular expert on veterinary matters, but as the author of a new book. It's his third book. It's out this month, and it's called I Have Never Failed, But I Do Have Extensive Experience with Things That Absolutely Won't Work. Oh, man. We'd love to hear from you as we talk, and I hope you'll join in. What's your favorite piece of advice, maybe? Has this year helped you slow down and appreciate what you have? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Again, love to hear from you. And Dr. Bill Stork, welcome.
Well, thank you, Larry. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Congratulations on your third book. I enjoyed reading it quite a lot, to be honest. Why did you get started writing? Here you are, a veterinarian. Why'd you do this?
Well, I was raised by construction workers and farmers and blue-collar folks back home. And storytelling was always just lifestyle, and most of the time it was on the tailgate of a pickup truck or sitting around a campfire. But somewhere along the line, potentially influenced by one John Boy Walton, some number of years ago on Thursday nights when he would sit down and write his thoughts in a diary, that kind of got the party started. The book that probably cost my dad about 5,000 hours of overtime, All Creatures Great and Small, James Herriot, not only inspired me to go to veterinary school, but probably also prompted me to put pen to paper. And then here in Wisconsin, there is Michael Perry. And I would say from the time I picked up Population 485, I thought, man, first of all, that was the book I was intending to write. But since Mike wrote it before I did, I'm going to sit down and write my own book, because here I am surrounded by all these exemplary people. I need to celebrate them in word.
Yeah. Is this book, and I'm sorry to say I haven't read your first two books, is this new book similar to your first two?
Or a continuation of. I would like to think that I keep getting better. I think I at least get a little braver. I'm not confident that I would have taken on the Wall Street Journal the first time around, but it needed to be done this time. And I think hopefully I get a little bit more concise as time goes on.
Yeah. Well, you can't. You not only can you read the book, you have a smartphone. You can listen to a few of them as well, and that's kind of cool how that works.
I call that a live book. And back to the storytelling on tailgates and around campfires as a kid. A couple of years ago, I wandered into the High Noon Saloon in Madison to a Moth event. And for those not familiar, the Moth is an organization of storytellers that is a worldwide organization. And eventually I threw my hat in the ring and made my way to the stage and started telling stories in a more formal fashion. But bigger than that, I sat in the audience and I listened to stories, and I got all kinds of perspective from the other storytellers that I met. And back in March, we all got shut down from those in-person events. And I was looking for a way to keep the party rolling and also maybe to have some distractions every now and then. So I took my iPhone and I went out back, and at sunrise, sunset, out back down by the lake in the cab of my pickup truck, told stories to the back of my iPhone. And they made their way to a YouTube channel, and once the pile got big enough that I could publish a whole book, I kind of thought, well, I wonder how I could put the two of these together. And then came the QR codes. So in the book, on the back cover and in the table of contents, there are five stories that have QR codes. Scan your phone, and there I'll be telling the story.
Well, those are great stories. Maybe you should talk about the kinds of stories that readers will find in your book?
Well, it seems as if no matter what the point I'm attempting to make, I always end up telling stories about people. I try and tell stories about resilience. I end up telling stories about people. I try and write about perspective or making the most out of the darkest times of the year, and I end up telling stories about people. But the title, I roiled several options as far as titles are concerned. I was thinking about, you know, the idioms, axioms, and words of wisdom that have kept me in bounds all these years. And I thought about there is no such thing as bad weather. There's no end to what you can accomplish. If you don't care who gets a credit, enjoy every sandwich. But then I came to rest on I have never failed. And I wasn't entirely comfortable with the potential for perceived bravado with regard to that title. But what it did do is that title really weaves together the topics of the stories. And if there is a common thread, that would be of resilience, and resilience in many different forms, almost as many different forms as there are chapters in the book.
Yeah. Speaking of resilience, I was thinking about one of your chapters where you don't really mince any words about yourself when it came to getting into vet school and all of the issues. I tell you, as I was reading that, I was thinking about my own life as a new student, where my first semester in school was kind of almost a disaster for me at the university, but, you know, kind of made it through. But your story was kind of along the similar lines to my own.
Well, I wasn't necessarily proud of that moment, but I feel as if I grew from it. The 32nd adaptation is that my first year of veterinary school, you could say I took my eye off the ball. And in doing so, I achieved a grade point average that the administration was less than thrilled with, to the extent their recommendation was that I go home and work construction like my dad. But I'm not much on quitting, so instead I put my nose in my books and put the shoulder down. And I ended up graduating from vet school in 5 years instead of four. As a result, I can say that there's not a single day in the practice of veterinary medicine that I don't appreciate or fail to celebrate my clients and my patients. And there we go full circle, because that probably also has a lot to do with why I started writing in the first place, because I'm all about celebrating the extraordinary in what appear to be ordinary people.
Yeah. You mention in the book a couple of times, you mentioned the name Ed Detmers, and you I think described him as the legendary Ed Detmers, and I happen to know Ed, so I knew him. I didn't know him when he was practicing veterinary medicine, but met him after he was retired. But what makes somebody legendary?
I think persistence, if nothing else. I think Ed was a character of epic proportions. As a matter of fact, my wife was a veterinary technician for Dr. Detmers, which is how I ended up riding with him in the country while I was in vet school. Yeah, I mean, he was a character. He started off as an elementary school teacher, and when he wasn't able to necessarily handle adolescent boys, he thought his place was better in the barn. So he went up to the University of Minnesota and went to veterinary school and became a veterinarian. And with Ed, if you didn't have to dodge a stray scalpel during the day or a cow's foot, then it probably wasn't a full day of work. But he always answered the phone, and he always got the job done.
Yeah. Well, I brought it up because you are considered legendary by a lot of your of the folks who bring their animals to you, their pets to you, for help.
Well, to which I answer a couple of different ways. First of all, for that designation to be waved in front of you is very grounding, very centering. It's the kind of thing that motivates you to be a little bit smarter and do a better job. But also, I would say that it's in direct proportion to seniority and hairline. just for the simple fact that I've been here at this desk and in my pickup truck for the better part of 28 years, every now and then people will say kind things about you. So you go out and trying to continue to earn those kind words.
Yeah. And your practice has changed a lot over the years in terms of the percentages of farm animals you work with as opposed to pets.
From a 75% large animal, production animal practice to a 97% companion animal practice. And if there's an accountant in Wisconsin listening to this, they're going to call up and advise me to discontinue my farm animal practice. But the problem is I don't necessarily care to golf and I haven't fished for a while. So instead of taking days off, like for example, on Thursday, I'll get to go out and hang out with Ryan Hack on the Hack Farm and we'll be palpating cows, and you never know, Ryan will probably be quoting Margaret Thatcher while we're at it.
that's a great story. Well, tell me, there are so many articles, or chapters, I should say, in your book that struck a chord with me, and I'm wondering... Well, first, let me ask you this. What was the best piece of advice you think you ever got?
That would be from my dad, who said, shut up and do your work. And if you're worth a darn, language adjusted for public radio, people will notice. If you're not, they'll notice that too.
They'll notice that too. Well, you found in your writing so many local people or so many people that have would not be considered philosophers by any stretch. They're blue-collar folks, many of them. But they come through in your book as being very smart people in so many ways.
Which I speak to, if nobody else, I speak to my colleagues because... burnout and mental health issues are rampant, not just in the veterinary profession, but in dentistry, in the law at large. And I've been to continuing education meetings, and people have been asked to identify their biggest source of frustration. And I've had colleagues who will raise their hands and say their clients are their greatest source of frustration. With certainty, there are clients who can, at least initially, be frustrating to us. But personally, I find them the greatest source of inspiration for us. And one of the things that I speak to in all three of the books, they say you never get a second chance to make a first impression. I say first impressions are absolutely inevitable. They're human nature. However, we're doing ourselves a serious disservice if we don't give people a second chance. And there are legions of people who have come through our doors at the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic who first may not have been our favorite, may not have rubbed us in just the right fashion. But when you give them the benefit of the doubt, sometimes you find out that, one, they've had hardships that you had no idea. And two, maybe they've done things that are very nearly superhuman.
Dr. Bill Stork, our guest today, been with the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic for over 25 years and is an operator owner where he cares for pets great and small. And he's also an author. His book we're talking about here is titled, I Have Never Failed, But I Do Have Extensive Experience with things that absolutely won't work. Join in the conversation at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. What's the best piece of advice you've ever received? Is there a blue-collar philosopher in your life? What helps slow you down and appreciate things during these times? Give a call or shoot us an email. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Talking today with Dr. Bill Stork, Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, about his newest book, the third in his series of books that he's written. This one's titled, I Have Never Failed, But I Do Have Extensive Experience with Things That Absolutely Won't Work. Questions for him, give a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And let's take a call. Bob in Sturgeon Bay. We'll give you a chance now. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Hello. We have a couple cats that had eye problems, and a veterinary person up here, Dr. Venisi, kind of dropped what he was doing and fixed their eyes for them, you know, so they didn't lose the eye. And I just think he should be mentioned, you know, and all this stuff, because he's he just retired. I think he's about 80, and he used to work for zoos and things. And no matter what, you just showed, you know, you called and you went there and you took care of, you know, took care of your cat or your animal. And we really appreciated that.
And his stories about people like him and Ed Detmers and many others, Dr. Lee Allenstein here in Wisconsin are some of the names that kind of squares me up to be part of the same profession as people like that. So thank you very much for sharing.
Yeah, Bob, thank you so much. Appreciate it. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And maybe you've got an experience to share about someone who's touched your life, maybe a vet or maybe somebody else who gave you some great advice that you've used for a long, long time. Love to hear from you. Well, I want to go to some of the stories in a way here because they illustrate sort of what we've been talking about. You talk about your, and I think it comes through very well in one of the chapters where you talk about building your home and the kindness and the skills of the people who, the local people who you worked with.
And allowed my wife and I to play along. Our house was built by John Bound of JB Construction, and they built 3 years ago through the teeth of a hard, stinking winter. But at the same time, we pulled in materials from our guy Mark the Rockman. And if you drive down Highway A between Lake Mills, Wisconsin, and Watertown, there's a guy that has about an acre and a half of stones laying by the side of the road. And if you pull off the road and shake that man's hand, if we could be shaking hands right about now, he'll lift your heels off the ground. And you ask him how it is that he came to be a rock farmer. And he said, well, I used to be a truck driver. I got fired. And God told me that this is what I should be doing. And also along the way, we went looking for wood for our fireplace mantle. And we stopped in just a little closer to Lake Mills, also on Highway A. And we went to, I call him Uncle Jerry Topel. And he had chunks of walnut out back. And what do you think of those, Bill? Man, those would make nice railings and a fireplace mantle. So Jerry and I threw them on the sawmill, and next thing you know, we had a mantle to work with. And so it goes. There's very few. There's as few materials in our house that came from a semi that got delivered as possible. Our sinks are all homemade, handmade from friends of mine who are potters. This is a gratuitous plug for Mark Skudlerik at Cambridge Wood Fired Pottery, made farmhouse sinks. And I mentioned the idea to him, and he said, Bill, you realize a rectangular sink will fly off my potter's wheel, don't you? I said, well, yeah, Mark, but what if I were to build a box in the shape of a farmhouse sink? You could press the clay into the walls of that box and glaze it with one of the glazes, my favorite cereal bowls that I broke several years ago. And we could have ourselves a handmade farmhouse sink. He gave it a go, and there it sits in our countertop today.
And these are all really people who are craftsmen or craftswomen in their own right. But a fairly humble bunch.
Well, they certainly are.
Will in Eau Claire will give you a chance. Hi, Will.
Hi, guys. Great program today.
Thank you.
I just wanted to offer a couple of sage nuggets from my father when I was a young guy starting out doing stupid stuff. He sat me down one day and he said, look, I don't care what you do, but do your best at it. You know, I don't care what it is, but always do your best. And be honest about it with whatever you do, with yourself and with other people. And that has so many implications, and it's been such wonderful advice when I'm up against it. So anyway, that's it. That's my thought. So thanks, Paul. Catch you later.
Yeah, thank you, Will.
I think the simple pieces have a tendency to be the best pieces. And my friend Kishan Kamani once said, if in doubt, do the right thing.
Yeah.
Doesn't get much simpler, doesn't get much more universal than that.
Yeah. Kent in Pulaski, it's your turn. Hi, Kent. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Good morning, guys. Hey, you just brought attention to a story. This is back in the, I worked at a lumber company, and a truck came in, and I knew we were waiting on this special order of lumber, and the guy didn't have his paperwork. He couldn't open it. I couldn't unload it without the paperwork, and I went to my boss, and I'm like, well, what's he going to do? How are we going to get this, you know? And he just turned to me, and he says, don't make someone else's problem your problem. And I was like, oh, my goodness. And I kind of use that a lot. And I was like, yeah, if I can't help, you know, he said, don't make it your problem. I always got a kick on that.
Ken, thank you so much. Good advice, Abel.
You bet.
Thank you for calling. Let's take another call. Dan in Franksville. Your turn. Hi, Dan.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, there used to be an animal clinic in West Dallas named Crawford Animal Clinic. There still is a Crawford Animal Clinic, but it has nothing to do with the original owner. But he was actually started out as a meat inspector out in Fort Atkinson. But believe it or not, back then in the 60s, he was caught reading a book or something about nuclear testing or something, and he became part of that COINTELPRO thing, and the FBI got him fired and stuff, so he started an animal clinic in his basement because he couldn't get a job nowhere else. But he was a storyteller. He's a regular guy, brought up in Chicago, and he met his wife, and she was so good-looking that he had to do almost anything for her. So, he never thought of being a veterinarian, but he did. But he was a big storyteller, and everyone loved him. When he quit, everyone almost had a panic attack because they didn't know where else to go. They'd meet someone that tells stories like that.
Everyone has a story to tell, and I will dovetail into that one briefly. My dad worked construction. As a matter of fact, he worked for 11 years on a nuclear power plant, which was probably a very large reason why I was able to graduate from veterinary school without any student loan debt, and also why I have a deep and abiding respect for craftsmen. But the nuclear power plant was started in 1979. And at the time, the walls of the power plant were 19 feet concrete thick. The rebar was big as a meat cutter's forearm. And I asked Dad, why did they have to build this thing 19 feet thick? Keep in mind, 1979. He said, son, they want to build this thing strong enough to withstand a full-on impact from a 747 at cruising speed. In 1979, we were thinking about terrorist attacks.
Wow. Oh, interesting. And Dan, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it very much. I just remember one little piece in your book about conversations and talking with people and the importance of listening. Sometimes you talk about isolation a little bit in that chapter, but you talk about spending a little bit of time with a lady and her cat, I think. Can't remember.
Well, sure. You asked me at the top of the show what the best piece of advice I've ever gotten, and I told you one piece of advice I got from my dad. Another one was, son, I've never learned a thing with my mouth open. And that one holds up pretty well also. And the story you could be referring to was Sylvia Sipple. One of our clients walked in one day with a dog that didn't seem as if it was going to be able to make it from the parking lot to the clinic. Long story short, it was in congestive heart failure. We took x-rays of the dog, and its chest was filled with fluid. We did a chest tap and removed 1.5 liters of fluid from that dog's chest, and it trotted out of the clinic. She asked me how long I thought it would do okay. I said, Sylvia, days at best. The next morning, Sylvia was in the parking lot with the dog, and I thought, oh my God, this dog is decompensated, and now we're going to have to put it to sleep. And instead, the dog was running around the back, walking around the backyard, kind of halfway playing with the ball, and breathing much easier than it was the day before. And she looked up at me, and Sylvia Sipple is my voice of reason, and she said, okay, now it's time. The point of that story is that we, as veterinarians and people who cared for their animals, had the opportunity to not only spare that dog its worst day, but let it pass at a time when it was feeling good rather than struggling for its very next breath.
Oh, boy. Yeah, it's quite a story.
We learn from our clients every day.
Yeah. Steve in Madison, let's turn to you now. Steve, thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. It's a very interesting program. I have a little piece of advice that I have kept in mind ever since law school. And I think the best thing advice I ever got in law school 40 years ago was in my evidence class from Professor Frank Turkheimer. And he said, you know, there's always the maxim in the law of on cross-examination, don't ask a question unless you know the answer. But Frank Turkheimer said, on the other side of that axiom is, if you don't swing, you don't hit. And I've used that over and over in my life because you can never figure out how things are going to go. You can try to make your best judgment, but in the end, you got to decide whether to swing. And if you don't swing, you're not going to hit.
Well, I will answer that in two ways. The veterinary corollary to never ask a question that you don't know the answer to. In medicine, my follow-up to that is never ask a question unless I know what I will do with the answers to that question. But the extension or a potential adaptation of that same piece of advice, the you don't hit if you don't swing. Dr. Stanley Curtis told me once upon a time, Bill, just pick a direction and go like heck.
There you go. Steve, thanks a lot. That's a great piece of advice, and I appreciate it. Lynn in Spring Green, what's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you. Wonderful show. You've inspired me. When I hang up, I'm going to have to start writing. And this is what I'm going to write about, some things that my paternal grandpa taught me. He was an osteopathic physician, and when he retired, he became a craftsperson. He became a master photographer and did woodworking. And when we would arrive at their place, which is outside of Waupaca, here's what would happen. We'd get out of the car, my brothers, sisters, mom, dad, and I, and the first thing Grandpa would say is, don't go over there, that's where the poison ivy is. No matter how many times we came, and it was many times, he always set that limit. The next thing that happened is that he would sort of turn to me, and we'd start walking up to the back door, and he'd point to this big rock and say, what does that look like? And I'd always say turtle, and that rock's actually outside my door right now. And then pretty much for the whole time we were there, once we had the limits, and once we were sort of cautioned to pay attention and look around us, we were just free to go out in the boat, fish, track animals do whatever we did. And the other thing about him is that he preferred the company of young people. So as I'm sitting and listening to you, I'm realizing that every time we came there, he taught the same lessons. He gave limits. He taught presence. Look around, be here now. He gave us room to grow and learn, and he made sure that no matter how old you are, we knew how to have fun.
So. Wow. Lynn, thank you so much for calling. Dr. Bell, comment?
Well, two comments. One, there was an outright lack of technology in all of those beautiful moments that you shared. And one of the chapters in the book that I speak to is called Break My Mind. And it's one of the more serious chapters in the book. And I drag up a bunch of research, the point of which is that although technology is an outright necessity these days, it is also the presence of technology is crippling us, blinding us, and dumbing us up. And God bless you for spending all those time on the lake trapping and on the boat fishing. And the other thing is, bless you for spending time with your grandpa, because one of the other chapters in that book that I speak to is about loneliness. And that one has never been more relevant than it is right now, because among the people that I think a lot on during this pandemic is the elderly and the alone. And the effect is positively devastating. The CDC likens the effect of loneliness to smoking a pack of cigarettes or drinking 6 alcoholic beverages per day.
Yeah, it is absolutely amazing. And in that chapter, that was the one that I was rethinking about when I asked an earlier question. You were spending some time kind of at the end of a day with someone who was talking, and you were kind of thinking about, you know, I'd like to get going and doing some other things, but then you thought about it and listened to her.
Yeah, and one of my tools in life, I've lost good friends. I've lost both of my parents, obviously, both of my grandparents as well. And above my desk right now, there's a quote that says, my dad used to say, to live on in the hearts of those you leave behind is not to die. And one of the ways that I deal with losing people that I feel so strongly about is that when the time is nigh, whether it's in the congregation of the Cobb Creek Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, at my friend, the amazing Dick Bass's funeral, whether it is sitting vigil by my dad's bedside when he was in his last few days, I very deliberately open my eyes and my ears and my pores and my soul and actively incorporate everything that is right and strong and beautiful. One, about the person that we're losing. Two, one of my favorite stories, one of the stories that I included in the live book, is about CNAs, these wonderful, underpaid, underappreciated, unbelievably hardworking, compassionate, beautiful people who take care of people in extended living facilities. So, yeah, back to listening. Never learned a thing with my mouth open.
Did, you know, I've gotten some people asking about how do we get a copy of your book or your books, but the latest for sure here that we're talking about, I Have Never Failed. How do we get copies of the book?
Good of you to ask. A place would be drbillstork.com. I have a website. That website has a store, and as an act of inventory management, namely, I have more of the second book than I care to admit. I would be more than happy to make you a beautiful wooden box and put all 3 books in them and send them to you. The individual books are also available at drbillstork.com. Or let's support brick and mortar and local as best we can. One of the many bookstores who have been doing an amazing job is Joanne Berg at Mystery to Me in Madison. One, she's open to foot traffic, limited people, maximum space. But she has also pivoted her business to an online platform that is amazing. You may find a book that you thought about yesterday on your doorstep today. And Joanne at Mystery to Me is a longtime supporter of local authors, regional authors, and readers as well. So it's on Amazon if you need to, but there is a reason why Jeff Bezos has enough money to send people to space. They get most of the money. So if you can keep it closer to home, please do.
And Joanne at Mystery to Me, you're absolutely right. I've had lots of dealings with Mystery to Me, and it is a wonderful place. But your address again, Dr. What's the email for, I'm sorry, the website for ordering?
DrBillStork.com, all lowercase.
DrBillStork.com, all.
And all lowercase, yeah.
All lowercase. Well, I tell you what, this has been great conversation. By the way, just one other question. You use a lot of names in your book, and these are real people's names. And I'm wondering, do you talk to them beforehand, or do you tell them what's coming, or how'd you do that?
Well, these are all people that I'm pretty familiar and comfortable with my relationship with them. So I'm happy to say positive things about them and let it be a surprise when they're on Wisconsin Public Radio. There has been two names that have been changed. One, we'll call him Prius Pete because he flipped off my friend Ned Healy from a Prius in a 40,000-pound tractor going down the road. But we keep it positive, we keep it happy, and we're very comfortable celebrating those people.
Is it difficult to write about personal things like you do?
I don't think so. I think, and that has been put to me before, I think it's becoming increasingly easier. I will say that I thought it was a bit of a brave step, especially in case any of my clients are listening, to admit that it took me 5 years to get through vet school, which is supposed to take four. But I think after 28 years, hopefully I've got enough credibility that that becomes a point of pride rather than
I tell you what, you've got a lot of credibility, Dr. Bill Stork, and I've talked with a few of your clients, and they all sing your praises to the heavens. So
We arranged them to call you in an organized fashion. It's kind of like stacking positive comments on Facebook.
Well, there are so many funny parts in the book, too. I had some good laughs when I read it. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us and talking about I Have Never Failed. But I do have extensive experience with things that absolutely won't work. Thank you, Bill.
You bet. Thank you, Larry. Appreciate it very much.
Dr. Bill Stork, our guest. Well, that was a lot of fun. I think it probably brought a lot of memories to people about their own friends and their own vets and their own people that had an impact on their life. It was great fun talking with him today. We're going to turn our attention to pancreas cancer next with a couple of guests, former Governor Tommy Thompson and Dr. Sam Lubner. That coming up next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.